considered open that.
Of today's gathering is not just to analyse the situation as it stands at the moment, but to try and look for ways of taking this forward in a positive way. We've had one or two suggestions which have come up, but the purpose of the second session is to try and look at practical options. And I may say now that at the end of this seminar today, I will ask all of you who may also have got options and suggestions and have not been able to get them across at this meeting, to let Ian Walker know what they are so that we can build them into further meetings of different sorts in the future, so that we can perhaps try and put together some very practical options in a published way which we can then work on. But I'm going to ask the first of our three speakers on this panel to talk to us. He is His Royal Highness Prince Al-Hassan bin Talal of Jordan, who was for many years the Crown Prince of Jordan. But in terms of what we're looking at today, I think more importantly, he established in 1994 the Royal Institute for Interfaith Studies, so in a sense well before the others in the area were beginning to think this way, he was thinking about it. He proposed the establishment of the new international humanitarian order, which led to the Secretary General of the United Nations asking him to found and co-chair the ICIHI. He also co-founded the International Cultures Foundation, and was elected as one of the five regional experts in the Independent Eminent Experts Group established by the Secretary-General of the United Nations, and I could go on for a long time on many others. But I would just like to say that in 2004, he formed the Parliament of Cultures, promoting understanding among different cultures. So he is someone who has not just commented on the situation, but has come forward with positive solutions, and I'm delighted he's here with us today, Your Royal Highness.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, years ago, two gentlemen, one from the northern and one from the southern hemisphere, I think whom we all respect in memory, Yehudi Menuhin on the one side and Walter Sisulu on the other, both said to me personally, why are we always working against something? It's always a phobia. Why can't we work for something? And in that context, I want to say that my comments will be generic and organic. Let's start with the generic and say that 84%, according to the Pew Research Religion and Public Life Project, of people in this world identify with a religious group. That's more than 8 in 10 people. Moving to the organic, 70% of the world's refugees are Muslims. And I want to say that years ago, when my name was proposed as commissioner for the High Commission for Refugees, a former Secretary General said they will never accept a Muslim. I said, any Muslim or just me? And they said, no, just you. Because the first thing I would have said to the wealthy in this world, why are you not creating a universal Zakat foundation? According to my colleague Peter Sutherland, who heads the Mobility Commission of the United Nations, mobility stakeholders are on Venus and national stakeholders are on Mars. And returning to our region, let me identify it as West Asia. I have to tell you that by 2030, 45 million Egyptians are going to be on the march because the Mediterranean Sea is going to swamp, literally submerge the delta. The dam that is being built in Ethiopia is going to deoxygenate the water, so there will be no possibility of agriculture. And correspondingly, 45 million Iranians are going to be on the march because of drought conditions. So the raising of sanctions in areas that would help people to stand on their feet, enable them and empower them as citizens is hugely important. My third point is that citizenship is the key to success, in my humble opinion. Churchill, looking at the ruins of Europe in 1946 in Zurich, said, we need a broader form of patriotism. Not nationalism, mind you, but patriotism. A broader form of belonging. If you can be a European, a German, and a Bavarian Catholic, why can you not be an Arab, a Syrian, and an Aleppo Catholic? I have had the privilege of writing a book on churches of the Eastern Communion. I recognize the contribution of the Metropolitan in the 3 points to which he has alluded, but I would like to speak to the representative of the Russian embassy, ambassador, to thank him for his presentation and to say, please consider once again that today is 2014. 1914 to 2014 was what Karen Armstrong and I have been contemplating about for a long period of time. She and I were both members of the same university as Michael Lothian, and to my amazement, she and I have both been described as antichrists. But I felt I was in good company when I discovered that Ian Paisley had described Pope John Paul as an antichrist. The reason for that, I assume, is that some of us are trying to swim upstream. The Holy Prophet says, if the day of judgment comes and you have a fruit-bearing sapling in your hand, plant it anyway. So what I see in the chaos in our part of the world at the present time is the total disregarding of Eisenhower's famous speech in 1959, warning of the military-industrial complex. And as far as the three words that you commented on, Lord Howell, I would like to point out that military intervention has taken place in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Pakistan. So two of those countries neighbor us. Shimon Peres once said to me, we are surrounded by enemies. I said to him, you think you have a problem? We're surrounded by friends. The fifth country is Nigeria, and I leave it to you to judge what military intervention has done there. As far as energy is concerned, I would like to suggest that the broader patriotism was the patriotism of Monnet and Schumann. They suggested a coal and steel community. Why can we not suggest a water and energy for the human environment community for our region? When will the sovereign wealth fund managers of the Gulf, who are not known to us mortals, wake up to the notion of security through stabilizing the region, through investment in job opportunities and human dignity? My friend Vartan Gregorian calls me an honorary Armenian, and I call him an honorary Muslim. And I respect the fact that in one of his recent speeches, he chose the title, Dignity is Not Negotiable. What we're talking about here is human dignity. The correlation is not between sustainability and triumphalist investment. My great-grandfather, the Sharif of Mecca, recognized that when he said to the then allies, the British and the French essentially, I will not allow the exploitation of oil until self-determination has been created. And self-determination was for Jews of Arab culture, Muslims of Arab culture, and Christians of Arab culture. Self-determination was to continue in Mecca, in consultation, which is the end of Hajj, Shura, between the four schools of Ahl Sunnah wa Jama'ah, the two schools of Shia and the Ibadis. And 10 years ago, I discussed this with the current king of Saudi Arabia, and in Tehran, I brought it up again last year, and they said, yes, but in addition to the madahib, the schools of jurisprudence, we want to have the political schools. So I said, you want me to sit next to the last of the Ahl al-Kuna, as we call them, the ciphered names, Abu this and Abu that, who don't even grace us with seeing their faces. I think one of the speakers said traditional Muslim dress. There is no such thing as traditional Muslim dress. You are meant to dress in a modest way. You go to the Hajj as a woman with your face clearly defined. But I want to say that these iconoclasts, as you have described them, are basically seeking political power, not structured political power. The word Cromwellian was used. Cromwell at least introduced the context of res publica, al-khayr al-am, al-salih al-am, the public good. But I don't see any public good being introduced by people who want to dominate. There's a great difference between cultural hegemony and domination. And I would like to suggest that the cultural hegemony of the Ottoman state at a given moment was actually heterogeneous. It was not domination in the sense of my way or the highway. So I would like to comment on these three or four points that we've heard today, if I may. You have mentioned, Professor Windsor, my dear brother, you have mentioned mainline Sunni Islam. I would like to point out that there is no such thing at the present time as mainline Sunni Islam. It is only when the Azhar possibly retrieves its health to a point where it can call a meeting of the schools of jurisprudence that we will find mainline Sunni Islam interacting. It is only when, and I am going from here to Rome, a meeting attended by Sunni and Shia and the Pontifical Council. I then go to Tehran to yet another religious meeting of Sunni and Shia. And I would like to thank the Basel Initiative, but may I just suggest that why are we only talking about protecting Christians in the Middle East? I remember militant Christian theology, when we were trying to work Evaristo Arens, then Cardinal of São Paulo and your humble servant, with the children of the streets of São Paulo. The Curia was not that impressed, the Vatican was not that impressed, because we had to talk to militants to get to these people. And to talk to the poor, we have to talk to militants as well. So this is the problem, that the other day two brilliant Jordanian authors, Muhammad Abu Rumman and Hassan Haniya, wrote a book funded by the Frederick Ebert Stiftung entitled Ana Salafi, I am a Salafi. And there were the four forms of Salafi there. Of course, the one who wanted to cut my head off said it is better to die a martyr's death than to die in bed. So I said, I assume you're not speaking from experience. So I would like to suggest also that in the points that were discussed today, the Muslim world should be sorting itself out. May I suggest that the Muslim world sorts itself out along with the rest of that 84% in the context of a search for a humanitarian order? I had the privilege of presenting Pope Francis with a template of hope, which I hope and pray would be raised by him when he visits the United Nations next year. He visited the European Parliament and spoke of the problems of migrants and said that the Middle Sea, the Terra Media, the Mediterra, should be a sea that is shared by all of us. And please answer me, what is the difference between good neighborhood policy in Europe and Eurasian policy? Asia is in Europe. Rome is in Ukraine. There are problems of Christians and Christians, let us face it. There are problems of Muslims and Muslims. There are problems of Jews and Jews. I was driving into the Vatican as Shimon Peres was driving out of the Vatican. And what does he call for? He calls for a United Nations of religions. But if we can't develop a United Nations of pragmatic ideas, how in God's name are we going to develop a United Nations of religions? I would like to suggest that the conversations that are being held are not between religions. They are between nufus, between human spirits, not between nusus, texts. Texts are not in dialogue. And Shimon Peres suggests that this would be an unquestionable moral authority. The Vatican has a curia. We Muslims do not yet have a distinction between Mecca, the capital, spiritual capital of Islam, and Riyadh, the political capital of Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that, with all due respect, the founder of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia said, Riyadh is my capital. I would also like to suggest, in the context of nations and religion, I was once suggesting that the Holy See was a very large theology. And someone said, yes, but it's a small state. I said, yes, a small state and a large theology. But I don't want to suggest that Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, where I'm going in a few days' time, is exclusive in its representation of Shiaism. It is not. Nor is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia exclusive in its representation of the Sunnah. So I believe that maybe the time has come to read the recent tea leaves. I noticed that Mr. Sabhani, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran, today criticized Assad and Maliki, and for the first time he says, the protests in Syria started peacefully, and the Syrian government responded with force. Now, I don't know about moving sands, but it does seem that the sands of our region do tend to move haphazardly. But if we are here to do anything at all in 2014, and in expectation of that invitation that was extended by Moscow for a regional, possibly an international conference, I think it's time, with all due respect, that the United States and Russia set the good example by beginning to talk to each other. Because the problems that we are basically addressing are problems of zones of disorder and zones of order. That map is not very busy, that carpet is not very busy, but if it was busier, every single color would be a sect or an ethnicity. Overlay on top of it the oil pipelines, the gas pipelines, and the water pipelines, and the waterways, and you would not have to be a rocket scientist to discover where the next explosion is going to be. As for people, as we speak today, far, far from human dignity, we are hell's firewood. I conclude with Rainer Maria Rilke, Letters to a Young Poet, 1875 to 1926. She says, live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer. I spent 40 years of my life trying to live my way into the answer. At least I know, or I think I know, the difference between right and wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Your Royal Highness. You've certainly given us a lot of food for thought in what you've said, and certainly I asked for suggestions, and we've had plenty of those from you, and I'm very grateful. I'm now going to call on the second member of this part of the panel, His Grace Bishop Angelos, who's the General Bishop of the Coptic Orthodox Church in the United Kingdom. It is the largest Christian denomination, as we know, in the Middle East, and is the ancient Church of Egypt. He was consecrated a General Bishop for the United Kingdom in 1999 and works extensively in the area of interreligious relations. Bishop.
Thank you, Lordship, and I feel that I'm in exceptional company to hear the insights, but also to look at the conversation. I think our starting point needs to be that when we speak about religious rights, they are actually rights and entitlements, not gifts by modern convention. We're looking at them as something that is a new creation, but actually within our context as Christians, they are God-given. And modern conventions like the Universal Charter and other such conventions merely enshrine and protect them. They provide a backing and a foundation for them to exist, and an accountability structure for all of us to be able to hold ourselves to that account on how we apply them and how we live them. There needs to be a new narrative in the Middle East. I think we need to stop speaking about religious or cultural minorities and start speaking about undeniable, unquestionable, unnegotiable human rights to everyone. As a Christian, I can't speak for human rights for my own people, yet see another group that is marginalized or victimized or alienated or persecuted and think that's okay. Ethically and spiritually, because God didn't ask us to do that. Pragmatically, because what goes around comes around. And if we don't safeguard what we do for all, it will come back to haunt us, either through our consciences or by attacking our own communities. When we speak holistically and we speak about human rights for all, I think it makes our voice more credible, more effective, because it is not swayed by a political ethos or a tribalism, but actually speaks about what we not only expect from others and for ourselves, but also for others and from ourselves. One very good model of that is the All-Party Parliamentary Group on International Religious Freedom and Beliefs that is part of this House, and that has become very effective because of the way that it stands for all and uses religious leaders and representatives from across not only this parliament, but also the life of Britain to formulate an approach and also then try to hold people to account based on that. Of course, there are many things faced by many groups in the Middle East. But we also can't pretend that the brunt of the persecution has not been faced by Christians over centuries. And I think we are now at a time where we need to ask ourselves why. It's because the people who are now persecuting not only Christians, but Muslims and Yazidis and people of no faith, are people who have such a narrow perspective that it very simply and justifiably to itself dismisses everybody else that doesn't fit within its understanding. And I think that's what we must challenge. That narrowness is not right. If we don't challenge it, what we're seeing now in Iraq is going to be a prototype of a justifiable model that will be replicated throughout the region and throughout the world. If Egypt had not drastically changed course on the 30th of June, we would have seen an IS-type existence in Sinai, because the then-president, Morsi, while he was still legitimate and elected president of Egypt, called for a caliphate, called for a parallel political leadership in his own state, because his allegiance was not to that state, but to a broader ideology that dismissed that state when it needed to. I also hope that we can change our language of the Western world and the Muslim world, because I technically am part of the Muslim world, which makes me either of lesser credibility or actually stresses my numeric state, my state of numeric minority, because we don't accept ourselves as minorities, we are indigenous people. But we are undoubtedly a numeric minority. We can't speak of the West and the Muslim world anymore because our worlds are well and truly intertwined. And the overused title of a global village is that reality we live at the moment. It's all very intertwined and interconnected. What happens in the Middle East has an effect here, and what has happened here has an effect in the Middle East. The narrative that we need now, I think, is one of indigenous communities, dealing with indigenous communities, communities that not only have a right to exist, because that's the baseline. Having a right to exist and the right to practice one's faith is a baseline. It is the lowest common denominator. But that these communities must be empowered to live their right, their belief. They must receive all the support they need to do that. We're talking about building of churches as being a luxury, where surely that must be a very basic right. As we approach the problem now, it is more problem solving than vision building. We look at a problem, we try to solve it, we think we're okay, so we move on to the next problem. I would very much agree with what I've heard from our previous speakers, and mostly His Royal Highness, by saying that we need to look at a new model. A model that doesn't just focus on problems and how to solve them, but focus on new interactions and how to nurture them. How to nurture a new understanding. How to nurture a new dynamic. How to nurture a new mutual respect between and for each other. And to realize that we need to listen to people in this region. We have become very prescriptive. We are telling people what democracy is. We are telling people whether they should or should not emigrate, or whether we will or will not grant asylum based on what we see as being their good. And we don't hold that position. We need to listen. We need to listen to what people think. Democracy is for them, not only as a philosophical concept, but as a practical lived reality. Because we all know that democracy is not just majority rule, which we have seen time and time again. And we should also talk about the viability and sustainability of these communities in the Middle East and ask them whether they are viable and sustainable. The model in Egypt and Lebanon is very different to that of Iraq and Syria. We're not going to vacate Egypt. The Lebanese Maronites have the same view. Yet people who are living under increasing pressure in Iraq may feel differently. And if that is their feeling, because again, this is not a philosophical argument, these are people who feel that they cannot safeguard and protect their families and their communities. And so they must be given the respect, but also the trust of self-determination. And we must be able to help how we can. There are many nation states within the region that sign up to all types of charters and understandings on human rights. Yet unfortunately, they're not lived out. They're not honored. It becomes a task rather than a responsibility of the state. It becomes a way by which we need to tick the right boxes. Rather than proactive and intentional leadership of providing people with their God-given rights, enshrined within documents upon which we've put our names. The dignity we've heard about is important because, of course, the huge breeding ground of a lot of this tension is illiteracy and poverty, and they need to be addressed because people who are vulnerable through poverty or illiteracy are very vulnerable to be indoctrinated financially or through religion, which is very easy. It's virtually impossible to separate the person and ideology and way of living in the Middle East from his or her religion and faith. It's very different to the Western model, so we need to understand that. I think in conclusion, I'd like to express my thanks to His Royal Highness in issuing a statement. I put up a little bit of a challenge. some months ago when the problem in Mosul started by saying, we need to hear voices. We need people to speak. And His Royal Highness and his institution issued a statement very powerfully directly after that. And that is the kind of witness we need to have together. We need to speak together. We need to have a legitimate voice together. We need to understand that we have a responsibility to every person within that state, within that region. Even people who have become indoctrinated, we have a responsibility, as Professor Winter said, to try to address that, because foreign policy is not going to address that. Addressing people, addressing mindsets, having a focus on the importance and the value of human life. Unfortunately, what we've seen over the past months is that people are being depersonified and presented as commodities to be bargained with. And when they no longer have a function, they are executed. We cannot afford to depersonalize and dehumanize each other. We must look at what holds us together as the image and likeness of God as He created us, and value that and protect it within every aspect of what that humanity entails, and first and foremost, that is our right to believe, or indeed not to believe.
Thank you very much indeed. I may say one of the key phrases you used was we must stop telling and start listening. And one of the things which has always struck me is that too often when we talk about dialogue, we think of dialogue as talking to people. Dialogue is in fact more often usefully done by listening to people. And that's a lesson I think that the West is still to learn. Now the third person on our panel, we're very lucky to have the Right Reverend Dr. Michael Ipgrave, was the Bishop of Woolwich in the Diocese of Southwark. He has a long history of interfaith work. He's been on the Interfaith Relations Advisory to the Archbishop's Council and Secretary of the Church's Commission on Interfaith Relations, and he's written extensively on these matters. He's Vice Chair of the Anglican Communion's Interfaith Network, and so I'd ask him to speak to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to contribute to this panel. I'm coming, as I do, from the in every way correct and inclusive Diocese of Southwark across the river. I'm very conscious that I'm the sixth male in a row to speak on this, but there's not a lot I can do about that. I think I've been invited to speak from the perspective of somebody who has been involved some time in interfaith dialogue and engagement, primarily in this country, but to some extent also in Israel-Palestine, not with much involvement in Iraq, or any involvement indeed in Iraq or Syria, but as previous speakers have said, this is an issue which spreads across the Middle East and indeed beyond. I want to begin with something that the Archbishop of Canterbury said a few weeks ago, where he reminded us of the importance of having a compelling and positive vision of what we are in favour of in this situation, and not just what we are against. And I think that's really important. I think that interfaith engagement can help in shaping that compelling and positive vision, though in face of the entirely dire situation in parts of the Middle East at the moment, the contributions of interfaith dialogue may seem ineffective, unrealistic, or indeed entirely risible. But I think it's very important to hold on to what Dr. Tim Winter said at the beginning about the long-term importance of theology. Interfaith engagement in general, interfaith dialogue in particular, is not the answer to this situation. It may not even be an answer, but I think it is a significant venture to attempt in the face of the tide of intolerance in the Middle East. And I take the point that actually measuring the impact of this is a real challenge, and it's interesting to know that there are thoughts of how to do that. So in terms of interfaith engagement or interfaith dialogue, I think what I want to do is just to briefly to point to five methodological principles, if you like, that seem to me important. First, that we should always be aware of location. Secondly, that this is about retrieving our religious traditions in the cause of generosity. Thirdly, that we need to widen the table. Fourthly, that we need to deepen the practice of dialogue. And fifthly, that we need to value modesty. I'll come back to that at the end. A little bit about those. I think we need, first of all, to be aware of the location, the context in which we're speaking. To state the blindingly obvious, we are speaking in the United Kingdom at the moment, and that is not the same as speaking in the Middle East. And being in the United Kingdom has both limitations and opportunities of its own. My experience of the impact of Israel-Palestine issues, in particular Middle East issues in general, on interfaith relations at street level in Britain, is that they can be polarising. They can have indeed a very destructive effect, as we saw on the streets of my own see of Woolwich just 18 months ago. But they can also surprisingly provide opportunity for communities, including young people from communities, to talk together. And I think there is an area of exploration of how our experience of interfaith relations here relates to that in the Middle East. The big difference, of course, is that we don't have to live with the consequences here directly of what we say about the Middle East. And I think the issue of language is really important. Language does not always translate easily from one context to another. And I was interested, because I was going to mention that too, to hear what Bishop Angelos said about the use of the word minority, which I think can be experienced, however well-intentioned its use, can be experienced as demeaning and constricting for people in some contexts. So always be aware of location. Secondly, it seems to me that what dialogue in this context is primarily about is encouraging one another as we seek to reclaim our religious traditions, the core heartlands of our faiths, for an Irenic generosity. And that is an issue for all of us in different ways, in different religions. It's not only an issue for Muslims, though it is perhaps most dramatically so at the moment, but it is an issue for Christians, for Jews, and for people of other faiths too. We need to recognise that in some sense we are in the same business about this. We need, particularly perhaps those of us who are religious leaders or who have a teaching function within our religious communities, we need to make sure that we don't allow extremist or exclusive accounts of faith to go unchallenged or to be paraded and recognised in wider society as the authentic version of the faith in question, and everybody else is a wishy-washy liberal. This is not the same as relativising faiths, nor is it making what I find the difficult claim that extremism itself makes no claim to be rooted in religious faiths, but it is setting out a different and a more authentic reading of our faith against extremism, one which affirms space for generosity and for hospitality towards the other. All of our faiths have resources to do that, and I want to say that that's actually at the heartland of all of our faiths, and we need to encourage one another in making that claim. Thirdly, we need to widen the table of dialogue, as Father MacDonald said, to avoid a dialogue of the like-minded. We need to recognise and give space for a variety of positions within each faith community or each faith tradition. And we need, as a corollary of that, not to back people into a corner by ascribing to them views which they may not themselves hold. One of the projects we're looking at in the Council of Christians and Jews, which I'm soon to be chairing, at the moment is looking at the question, who is a friend of Israel? I just lobbed that kind of rather explosive question into this. It's a slogan that's often used about friends of Israel, but how wide a range does, and how much critical friendship can one include within that? I think there is we know that there is a wide range of nuanced views within all our faith traditions. His Royal Highness spoke of four forms of Salafi, and I guess that's probably a conservative estimate of the number of forms of Salafis that there are. And we suffer from an electronic and particularly a social media that flattens out all those nuanced positions into easy to digest but ultimately indigestible sound bites. We need to create spaces where much more careful dialogue can happen. We also need to deepen the practice of dialogue, of what we think dialogue is about. I still find that people talk about interfaith dialogue in some contexts as if it is always about seeking agreement, about identifying common ground. Well, in my view, it is not. Dialogue is not a form of negotiation to arrive always at a common statement. It is very often about learning to disagree well, something which we struggle with in the Church of England, of course, and about as much about the exploration and clarification of difference as about the identification of agreement. One of the practices which I think is really interesting in leading into that is the practice known as scriptural reasoning, which is not a dialogue of text with text, because you can't have that, of course, because it's a text, but a dialogue of readers of scripture in one religion, dialoguing with readers of scripture in another, and bringing their texts as what is formative for their own faith into that. One of the interesting aspects of that is that it means that you have to deal with the bits that are difficult. And sometimes, as a result of that, you find unexpected convergence in places where you thought there was a wide chasm between you, and equally, great differences in areas where it felt as if you held the same ground. And I think that kind of digging deep into our core heartlands is really important, and not being afraid to disagree. And finally, I think we need to value modesty in this area. That is to say, recognising that small, limited steps can make a real difference. Not every project needs to be the entire answer to everything. And I share the disquiet about the idea of a United Nations of Religions, which would act as some moral arbiter for the whole world. I think there are lots of small, worthwhile examples, simple acts of kindness across boundaries and divisions, and sometimes more organised projects consciously designed to cross those barriers. It is a time that's very difficult to sustain work across those boundaries, but I think we need to seek out the good stories that are happening there and to give them a little more oxygen of publicity. I was very encouraged last week to be in this palace for the launch of the interfaith channel of the Jewish News, which has committed itself to doing exactly that. I think there is a real offering of hope in some of those small acts. As Archbishop Rowan Williams said, to those who say you're only offering hope in this situation, my answer is, well, if you've got something better to offer, we'd like to know about it.
Thank you very much indeed. I was interested when you said who is a friend of Israel. I've always taken the view in the years I've been trying to work out there that if you're going to succeed, you have to be a critical friend of Israel.
Absolutely.
And a critical friend of Palestine.
Absolutely.
If you're not both, then you really are not going to have any role in that area. And secondly, when you were talking about small steps, I was reminded of the saying that from tiny acorns, mighty oaks can grow. I think that's something also that we need to keep in mind. We've had an enormously good series of suggestions made. We've got to leave the room by 4:30, so we're not going to have a lot of time for people to offer their views. What I'd like to do is to start taking views from the floor. If you can keep them brief, I will try and get as many of you in as I can. I would like at the end, if possible, to have 10 minutes in which we can ask our panel just to respond, and I will give them each 2 minutes, or less than 2 minutes, and no more.